This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Today in Your Health, we'll report on young adults who go off to college this month with mental illnesses. Going to college is a particularly challenging turning point. Reporter Michelle Trudeau tells us how one family prepared for their son's departure.
2 weeks ago, Roger Deal left his home in Nashville, Tennessee, and entered the freshman class at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. He's registered for courses in chemistry, multivariable calculus, and history. And tomorrow, Roger will register at another office at the university's Disability Resource Center. Here's what he plans to say to them.
I have some conditions, and, well, I don't need any help right now. I just want them to know that I do have some conditions and get myself registered with them so if something comes up, then I can get help quicker.
Roger wants people to know up front about his conditions.
I'll tell them that I've been diagnosed with Asperger's.
This is a form of autism characterized by difficulties in social interactions.
ADHD and clinical depression.
And particularly with clinical depression, being away on his own at college could be risky for Roger. His mother, Sita Deal, recalls realizing early on how truly life-threatening depression could be for her son.
My first impression of his depression was when he was 3, and I was worried about him because he was beginning to say that he wanted to kill himself. And
I wasn't actually thinking about ways to commit suicide. I was just thinking of the desirability of doing so. I remember that.
Yeah. And then when he was 6 or 7, he would ask me about methods to commit suicide. Like he'd say, if I put this plastic bag over my head, how long would it take to suffocate? Or if I open this car door and fall into traffic, am I sure to be killed?
It was at that point that the Deals started to get psychiatric help for their son. As a 7-year-old, Roger was put on the antidepressant Prozac and then Ritalin for his ADHD. And although Rogers had several more depressive episodes, he nevertheless graduated from high school with straight A's. He applied to colleges and was accepted at several. He was a finalist for a National Merit Scholarship and has received 2 academic scholarships at Wisconsin. Rogers is smart, works hard, but he faces difficult challenges ahead. Freshman year in college is a very risky time for many teenagers, but it is a particularly high-risk moment for Roger because of his struggles with depression and other mental health problems. Roger's mother has planned for this. Sita runs Tennessee's National Alliance on Mental Illness, and in counseling families, she's come to recognize that preparations must be made for Roger's transition from home to college.
For many years, I've heard families talk about how their child was at the top of his class and he was just wonderful, and then he went off to college and everything fell apart. And so I was determined that we were going to learn from experience, and whether or not it was something that Roger needed, we were going to build a bridge for a gradual launch rather than just pushing him out of the nest.
Building that transitional bridge for a child with serious mental health problems requires many steps, Sita Deal says, beginning with the choice of college. One reason the Deals chose the University of Wisconsin is because of the social support network in Madison.
That's where our extended family lives. For the first year, he's going to be living with his grandmother just to make that transition gently. And his favorite cousin lives there. And so he'll have a ready-made social system.
There's also the legal transition. Roger turned 18 in May, so he's now a legal adult. His parents no longer have the legal right to be involved in his medical care, even though he's at risk for depression and suicide. The family's prepared for this, too, in advance, by finding a psychiatrist for Roger in Madison. He's already met with her.
She's the person who I'll check in with every month, just as a checkup appointment, to make sure that everything's going all right.
Numerous other preparations have been made in advance.
We went to an attorney who is Roger's attorney, not our attorney, and she determined that he, under the circumstances, that he needed a financial power of attorney.
Roger has given power of attorney to his grandmother.
Then a mental health care power of attorney and a health care power of attorney, a living will, and then a HIPAA release.
A HIPAA release refers to the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, a federal law that protects the privacy of an adult's medical information. By signing a HIPAA release, Roger agrees to let his parents remain involved in his medical care, much as when he was a dependent. For parents of adult children with mental illnesses, a HIPAA release is critical, Sita says.
I've heard so many parents say at the age of 18, the wall comes down and it's a real shock. Suddenly, people we've been talking to for years can't talk to us anymore.
With the HIPAA law in place, medical staff is protective of patients' privacy.
They're very, very reluctant to give information, and you do have to wave this paper in front of them and say, this has been signed by the patient when he was making good decisions.
Roger is also writing an advanced directive, documenting the kind of medical intervention he wants if he becomes incapacitated. And with chronic severe depression, becoming incapable of making good medical decisions is a real concern.
He'll work out what he wants and where he wants to go and how he wants to be treated and what medications and that kind of thing, and if he becomes incapacitated.
How do you feel, Roger, about all these legal preparations?
It feels very good. It feels a lot better than not having my family know about what sorts of treatment I'm getting if I'm determined to not have capacity. I'd rather have them know and be able to make decisions than, well, the doctors making the decisions by themselves.
Do you feel like your independence is being curtailed by your parents?
I actually feel it's adding to my independence because I feel they'll be more responsive to my wishes than someone I don't know.
As classes get underway, Roger plans to talk directly to his teachers to prepare them for his mental illness behavioral issues.
I think they need to know what not to be concerned about.
Like he often gets restless in class and needs to get up and pace.
And also I often will snap or there are a number of hand behaviors that I'll do.
Such as rapidly flapping his hands.
So it's better if the teacher knows that it's nothing to worry about.
And Roger has also joined a campus club for canoeing and kayaking, his strategy to meet people in a relaxed way.
I'm not as social as most people. I don't make friends as quickly.
Roger plans to major in biochemistry. He loves science and math. He says he's very excited about the rigorous academic load ahead of him and the sheer wonder of learning new things.
I plan to find out what I like in science and get involved with it. It's a pretty general goal, but I've just came here, so I really only half know what this place is and what it can offer.
A remarkable young man, with a family supporting him, having prepared him to go off to college and thrive while living with the challenges of his mental illness. For NPR News, I'm Michelle Trudeau.
And that's your health for this Thursday morning. You hear it every Thursday morning on Morning Edition. There are pictures of Roger at the University of Wisconsin at NPR.org, and Roger and his mom will take listener questions this week.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
I'm Steve Inskeep, and in this part of the program, we're joined by a voice you normally hear at the other end of the day, Michelle Norris of All Things Considered. Welcome.
Good to be here, Steve.
She's here because we've both been listening to people try something that you might find daunting.
They agreed to answer our questions about race and each other's questions about race, and they did this in a room filled with people of all kinds of racial backgrounds.
What are the occasions, if any, when you become aware of your race?
Right now.
Are you comfortable?
Sarah?
It's a little uncomfortable.
Sarah Iacoviello is part of a group of voters we assembled. They all live in York, Pennsylvania.
We traveled to this city together because it's in a presidential swing state, and also because it's working to overcome a history of racial tension. Because it's radio, we need to say that I'm white.
And I'm black. and the group we gathered loosely reflects the demographics of York. Speaking frankly before this group of voters, white, black, and Latino, is what made Sarah Jacoviello uncomfortable.
I think that sounds strange, but I want to be made uncomfortable because I don't pretend to understand the plight of African American or Hispanic or any other nationality that's not my own.
Sarah Jacoviello sat next to Kel Weary. He's a high school drama teacher who says he's almost always aware of his race.
I'm not a blind black man. I do see what happens when I walk into certain stores. I do feel that, and I still feel the same anxiety I had when I was 5 or 6 years old and seeing the difference between my white friends when they walked in the store and how they were treated and how I was.
We're seated in a circle of armchairs and sofas at the Yorktown Hotel to dig a little bit deeper than election polls on that tricky subject of race.
We're in the center of a city that John McCain and Barack Obama both visited in recent weeks, but we took a while before asking how our 13 Americans might vote. First, we wanted to hear them answer questions like this.
Is discrimination underestimated by white Americans?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Nancy.
Whenever we saw racism of any form, we would always take a stand against it. But the place we had to start was ourselves. Mm-hmm. It was in us.
Nancy Snyder is white. She's adopted two children of different races.
I had this beautiful little 18-month-old African-American son whose feet were about this big, and you knew he was going to grow to be over 6 feet tall.
He had big feet is what you're saying.
That's right. And I caught myself, and my husband challenged me on it, saying, I figure I have about a decade to build a good rapport with him. And my husband said to me, would you ever say that if he were white? And
the implication being that if you didn't build a good rapport with him.
I was afraid of African-American men when they got to a certain height.
Is there anyone else in the room that has had to confront that in themselves? Driving down a street in York, seeing black men on a corner. Now, this is interesting. You're
a black man. He's raising his hand.
I'll be completely honest about it.
That's Cal Weary, the high school drama teacher. He says he changed when attending an almost all-white prep school.
I had a fear of black males because I was mimicking the fears that these people who I went to school with had.
You were afraid of men who looked just like you.
Right. Well, now I'm not, but I'm saying that I am the large black man that you would have feared coming to your door.
That remark prompted a response from Michael Smith, the large black man sitting across the room.
A large black man has to be very friendly. You know, they like a large black friendly man. You know what I mean? So,
I just want to flip the question. Do black people make too much of discrimination?
I think some do, and I particularly see it for some reason in the younger generation.
Charlotte Bergdahl is white, and she does business all over the city that spreads out beneath the windows of our hotel suite.
Somewhere beyond York's Victorian church spires, factories make Harley-Davidson motorcycles and York barbells. It's a vibrant city with many people on the move, and some of them rent apartments from Charlotte Bergdahl.
I see people who, even though they haven't put forth the effort that they need to save up the money to get an apartment or get the education to get the job they want, just expect that it's going to happen. And that they think that the reason that it hasn't happened is because
they didn't try.
I think it's because they didn't try, but very often they think it's because they are Hispanic or African-American.
And if you told them they didn't have it together, they would basically act like you're a racist.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Now, do you mind if we turn to the election? There's a question that pollsters often ask, and it goes something like this.
Do you think America is ready to elect a black president?
Now, when that question is asked, what do you think the pollster is trying to get at?
I think the question is, they just don't think a black person is smart enough.
Margie Orr.
They just don't think a black person is smart enough.
This is Don. I don't think there's to be a problem with a black man. I personally just don't think Obama's the right one.
Don Geddes is a constable, a former cop, and he's white.
For some reason, the media, they don't say anything bad about him when he does something wrong. It's never reported.
course, the media is going to do that because this is history making.
But if you're going to go after one, you go after both.
This is the first black man who's ever gotten to where he has gotten.
Margie, right? Should we then excuse any shortcomings because of what you just admitted? You said
Sarah Jacoviello is the white voter who told us she wanted to be in an uncomfortable discussion. And now she is.
You said this is history-making. So should we excuse, you know, failures on his part? When we know, I mean, he's a human, there are.
He isn't excusing anything. They're just reporting the news.
And since we started off with race,
Michael Smith, one of the black men in the room, says that when people talk about the media's failings, he hears white fear.
Blacks getting back at what America has done to them. That's the fear. I mean, it's not the context of this man's character. You're looking for something. You're looking for something. It's got to be something. So, and you say, well, the media isn't finding it for me. So they're giving him a fair ride because they ain't dug nothing out on him yet.
I wonder if that suggests something about our selection of a president or a vice president for that matter, that it's hard to make a judgment on the objective facts, and people end up making decisions based on their, I want to say, tribal beliefs. Does anybody think that's a proper suggestion?
If you subtract Obama's color...
Drama teacher Cal Weary.
And they're both two white guys. Even though I generally vote conservatively, I'm still looking at a bunch of other issues that still send me in the direction of Obama. There's another issue that's in my head constantly. You know, we've taken over, and I say we've taken over, like all the black guys get together and we talk about, well, we got football, and we got Tiger now, and like we all sit around and talk like that. And every time we attain another higher level, it's almost like white Americans feel like something's being torn away from them. And it's actually been said to me by some of my friends who are white. But there's something else that's with it. That every time that an African American male attains another one of these levels, and I'm saying male, that it opens it up to it being all right, to that melting, that changing, where people are like, well, he's the president, so that's all right for my daughter to date a black guy, and that's all right for us to cross these other lines. That's really the scary part, is that no longer will you be able to come out and find a group of people who are all these separate pieces. And every time that we cross those racial barriers, when we have a white guy who can dunk and a black guy who's the president, we're starting to mix together.
It's more likely to...
But we're seeing that.
We're listening to 13 American voters, black, white, and Latino, talk about race and the election. Our discussion continues this afternoon on NPR's All Things Considered.
Michelle and I will ask voters how they develop such different views. Some still believe Barack Obama is a Muslim.
When a presidential campaign is in full swing, the truth can be lost in a good story. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik takes a closer look at one such episode, Republican vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin's daily repetition of the tale of that bridge to nowhere.
If you haven't heard about the crusading governor of Alaska, then you probably didn't hear Sarah Palin rally the Republican Party faithful last week in St. Paul.
I told the Congress... thanks, but no thanks on that bridge to nowhere.
Or Monday on the hustings.
I told Congress, thanks, but no thanks for that bridge to nowhere.
It's become a key element of her political biography. Here's Ben Porritt, a spokesman for the McCain-Palin ticket.
Whether it's killing the bridge to nowhere or vetoing $500 million in government spending in Alaska over the last 2 years, she has earned and deserves the title of reformer of her state.
But in the past 10 days, journalists from the Los Angeles Times, USA Today, CBS, and NPR, among others, have separately looked into her account about saying no thanks to federal funds and separately knocked it down.
She was for it before she was against it and actively for it before she became actively against it.
That's Margaret Tolliv, a political reporter for McClatchy Newspapers, which owns the Anchorage Daily News. Tolliv says readers deserve to know the facts and that Palin is distorting her position towards special earmark projects like the bridge. The Associated Press reports Palin is seeking another $200 million in such projects for Alaska next year. As for the bridge, Bill Adair of the St. Petersburg Times and the website PolitiFact says he found Palin did not defy Congress.
Congress had already withdrawn the specific funding for the bridge. And even in Alaska, there were a lot of people who were opposed to it. It's not like she boldly stood up against it.
A bridge she herself had promised when running for governor had become an embarrassment, and she wanted to use her federal money for other projects. Listen to the language Adair uses next.
What she did was, seeing the political reality, she ended it. It's not that she really killed it, but she did perform the last rites.
Bill Adair says Governor Palin's account is a half-truth. Jack Nelson, the retired Washington bureau chief of the LA Times, calls it something else.
In my opinion, it's what it is. It is a lie.
That's not a word most journalists use, but Nelson does, after more than a half century in journalism.
Most of the time in past campaigns, when major news organizations have come out and said that something is totally false, the candidate will drop it. In this case, they're repeating it over and over and over.
But with so many other sources of information and opinion online, revelations in mainstream news organizations don't pack the same punch they once did. And McCain-Palin spokesman Ben Porritt says there's no reason to back down.
There has been a number of distortions about Sarah Palin's record as a reformer. But this isn't about claiming the title. This is about having a record to back that up.
Porritt points to a journalistic site, factcheck.org, to prove Palin is telling the truth. But factcheck.org wrote last week that Palin's line about the bridge is, quote, inaccurate. But that doesn't mean you won't still be hearing it.
I told Congress, thanks but no thanks for that bridge to nowhere. If our state wanted to build a bridge, we would build it ourselves.
That tape was from Palin's campaign rally yesterday. And once again, the crowd roared. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. We've been asking if we can find racial fingerprints on the ballots we'll cast this November. And by racial fingerprint, we're referring to the personal experience, the individual racial experience we all carry into the voting booth. Most voters say their decision between Barack Obama and John McCain is not based on race. But we're trying to get at something more subtle than the standard questions in a poll. We wondered if the decision is not based so much on the candidate's race, but on the racial experience of the voter. I've been listening to voters describe their experience with Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep. Steve, welcome to this program.
Glad to be here, Michelle. As you know, earlier today on Morning Edition, we asked a group of 13 voters if America was ready for a black president.
This afternoon, those same 13 voters will tell us more about their lives and their racial identity and how they plan to vote. And it should be noted that I'm black.
And I'm white. And our voters are black, white, and Latino, which means they're as diverse as the city in which they live. It's York, Pennsylvania, in a presidential swing state. And many of the voters told us this election has them thinking about race and new ways.
I don't know if I can see another old white man as president.
That's Cal Weary. He's a black high school drama teacher who voted for President Bush in the past two elections, and he knows that his declaration might sound harsh.
And that sounds very racist for me to say it that way, but it is about appearances, and it is about this country everywhere else being looked at as being the biggest lie. You tell everyone in the world that we have the greatest opportunities here. You tell them that anyone can start from shining shoes and become the in charge of a Fortune 500 company. But then you say to the rest of the world, you say, you can have everything, but you can't live in the big White House.
Race is a complicated subject. We all know that, especially when discussed in a diverse setting. And our three-hour discussion was more difficult for some than others. There were lots of folded arms, nervous sighs, at times confrontation.
This is Don. I don't think there's to be a problem with a black man. I personally just don't think Obama's the right one. He doesn't have the experience. Yeah.
Don Geddes is a law enforcement officer. He's white. And his remarks set off one of the black voters in the room, Margie Orr, a receptionist.
Can I? This is Margie.
Sure.
And I don't see your name tag.
Don.
Okay, my thing is, though, but what would make you think Palin would be? Okay, we know John McCain has medical problems. God forbid, if this man is elected, and this white female. So what you're saying is, though, the United States would rather see, as long as they're white,
no,
they don't care if she's even a female, but as long as it's a white person.
No, I don't think that's the case.
But she
has more executive experience than he does. He was a community organizer. That? Nobody's ever told me what a community organizer is.
Then maybe that's something then that you need to investigate.
To understand how or if race affects voting decisions, we first had to learn more about these voters' experiences with race. And we can begin with Margie and Don.
I can't recall anything that any privilege that I got because I was white. I mean, I went to city schools, but I don't know of anything that I got that because I was white that the black kids could have gotten the same thing.
Back in 63 when I graduated, and my family was the first black family who moved into the suburbs.
That's Margie Orr.
And we weren't wanted there, of course. And the whites did everything they could to intimidate us, to get us to move. But my parents were staunch-hearted people. We weren't going to budge. So, of course, we stayed there. We endured it all, the break-ins, the house being messed up, you know, the whole nine yards being called niggers.
Margie dabs at her eyes when questioning why diversity has to be enforced.
I mean, my parents taught me to love everybody. So I'm saying, but you have to be taught to love me? That's hard for me to understand.
This is Leah. I guess I grew up very sheltered. I really was totally unaware of prejudice.
Leah Moreland is a widow and former factory worker. She grew up on a farm.
And I lived at the end of the West Market Street bus line. And there was a black man would ride the bus and come out to the end of the line with his shotgun on the bus that would go groundhog hunting. Dad would go out and say, how many orders do you have? Because the people in the black community here in York ate groundhog. And in fact, my mother cooked groundhog. And he would go out and hunt, but I mean, there was no prejudice in my home.
Leah Moreland's home area is still trying to move past a long history of racial tensions. Like many American cities, York, Pennsylvania suffered a race riot in the 1960s. It lasted 10 days. These days, York's attorneys include Jeff Lobach. He's white, and he's surprised by the intolerance he sees in York even today.
White people are almost invariably shocked when they hear some of the things that African Americans have to put up with. It cuts across economic groups, too. African-American professionals in this town are treated differently. These are highly paid folks who are part of the haves now, and they are definitely treated differently
by their
peers.
How are they treated differently?
We have had incidents where white lawyers wouldn't shake the hand of a black lawyer.
After we heard their stories, we asked all the voters who they plan to back in November, and this is key. We also asked how their racial experience or identity, something we refer to as a cultural compass, factored into that decision.
Remember Margie Orr? She's the receptionist who still carries the scars of integration.
I'm a Democrat, and I'm going to vote for Obama. And one of my reasons is because he is black.
Margie Orr said her vote for Obama is based on pride. But you also hear a touch of paranoia.
And I think he's qualified. And come on, let's face facts. This man is going to be wiretapped up to his eyeballs. Come on, people. You really think he's going to be put in office and they not keep an eye on him?
What do you mean?
Be for real.
What do you mean? Who's they? Who's they is going to be
keeping an eye on? They're going to watch this man. What's that old saying goes? Like white on rice. He's not going to be his own person, per se. He's going to be screened to the max. They're not going to let him get away with anything.
Who's they is going to...
The white system. That's who they are. Okay?
Jeff Lobach, the attorney.
I think if Senator Obama is elected, it's not going to be because he's an African-American. I think we can all agree about that. If he's defeated, I hope it's not because he's an African-American. We can probably all agree about that, too.
He senses that change is in the air. Racial attitudes are shifting, including his own. But his allegiance to his party, that's still solid.
I'm an enthusiastic supporter of McCain right now because I think this is his moment.
And Leah Moreland, the woman who said she grew up sheltered from prejudice?
Right now, McCain is the man.
Party loyalty is also part of her decision, but her cultural compass also comes into play. She said her gut tells her not to trust Obama.
I look at Obama, and I have a question in my mind. Years ago, was he taken into the Muslim faith? And my concern is, the only way you are no longer a Muslim is if you are dead, killed. So in my mind, he's still alive.
There may be many comments about that, but do you want to continue?
Well, I want to continue around the room, but I just want to ask one. We'll have a chance to. I just want to go around the room quickly, and we'll come back to that. But I just one very quick question for you. Barack Obama has said repeatedly when asked this question that he is
not a Muslim
and has never been a Muslim.
So you're saying he's a liar.
Accept him as at his word?
No. No. I really don't, because I just, there's something about him I don't trust. I can't
you don't
help
believe
how
him.
Good a speaker he is. He just has not, I just can't trust him.
So at the end of the evening, we tallied up support for the candidates.
Well, we have 7 white voters, and we have 6 voters of color. The majority of the white voters are supporting John McCain. All of the people of color are supporting Barack Obama. What does that say? Coincidence? Or is something else at work?
This is Charlotte. But I only heard one person even say or think that the reason that they were voting that way was because of race.
Property manager Charlotte Bergdahl, an undecided voter, didn't see a connection between race and political choice, and she wasn't alone.
But after the voters spent a little more time debating that divide, again, all of the voters of color behind Obama, most of the white voters behind John McCain, most came to a reluctant conclusion.
So the question is still on the floor. Does race matter on a subconscious level?
Yes.
Could I make
Michelle?
Does.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It does. Apparently.
Yeah.
Could I make
apparently. But it was not apparent when we first asked voters if race was a factor in their decision.
So that raises one last question. Just how much are we all aware of our own biases or our own fears?
Cal Weary, that black drama teacher, former Bush backer and current Obama supporter, says deep divisions on race, this group's and the country's, might always be an obstacle.
When someone asks a question like, is America ready for a black president, they're saying, has America forgotten what it's done to black people? And have the black people forgotten what has been done to them? Is he going to be able to go in there and be respected? Because they're still making comments like, oh, but he's so well-spoken. And, mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness, you know, he's different than the rest. The same kind of thing that I grew up with. And I understand why they're asking the question. If you ask me if I think America's ready for it, I don't think they are. But when are we ever ready for anything that is a radical change? Mm-hmm.
The voices of voters in York, Pennsylvania. And we're not done listening. We're going to head back to Pennsylvania next month to hear more.
And if you want to hear more from this visit to York, go to npr.org. There you can listen to our report from Morning Edition.
Next, we have a story about that classic trio, sex, drugs, and oil royalties. The Interior Department's Inspector General has described a, quote, culture of substance abuse and promiscuity at a government office that manages income from oil drilling in the United States. NPR's Justice Correspondent Ari Shapiro has more.
Anyone who thinks government publications are boring needs to read these reports by the Interior Department's Inspector General. They focus on an office in Denver that's part of the Minerals Management Service. MMS handles oil and gas company payments for drilling in the U.S. It's one of the federal government's biggest sources of income, apart from taxes. According to these reports, office employees accepted tens of thousands of dollars in gifts, and they, quote, used cocaine and marijuana and had sexual relations with oil and gas company representatives.
We now have proof that they are both literally and figuratively in bed with big oil.
Democratic Senator Bill Nelson of Florida has fought against new offshore oil drilling. Congress is about to start debating just that. These reports give Nelson ammunition.
Big oil has used sex and drugs and illegal gifts with U.S. government watchdogs that are charged with keeping a watchful eye on the oil industry's offshore leasing program in the Gulf of Mexico.
But there were internal problems, too, that had nothing to do with the oil companies. The inspector general describes the government office as having, quote, a culture of ethical failure. David Smith is a spokesman for the Minerals Management Service.
As public employees, we hold ourselves to a higher standard, especially in the ethical realm. And this type of behavior is not something that we condone.
He says his office was pleased to get the reports.
This is an investigation that we requested back in 2006 after an MMS employee raised allegation of ethical lapse.
One employee already pleaded guilty to violating conflict of interest laws. Investigators recommended firing those who were still working in the office and making sure they never work for the royalty program again. Some people who already moved on may not face any consequences. Spokesman David Smith says his office is reviewing the report's recommendations and will decide on the best course of action. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.
Is a tattoo art? How about a pig with tattoos? These questions have been brought into sharp focus after Chinese authorities censored a major art show called SH Contemporary. It recently opened in Shanghai. NPR's Louisa Lim paid a visit.
I'm here at SH Contemporary. It's Shanghai's largest art fair. And this year, one thing that everybody's talking about is something that didn't actually happen. Eight pigs tattooed with Louis Vuitton logos and Walt Disney characters were supposed to be exhibited as part of an artwork by the Belgian artist Wim Delvoye. But these were banned by the Chinese authorities. Now, Wim is here with me now. Wim, do you know why your pigs weren't allowed to be shown?
Not because of sanitation issues, not because of animal rights, not because of ideological considerations, not because there's something anti-communist on it, or not because there's nudity on it. But this time they were not allowed because it was not art.
One of your artworks that has made it here is actually a person, a Swiss man called Tim, who has these tattoos that you've designed all over his back. Now, as part of this exhibition, Tim actually has to undress. He's now unbuttoning his shirt and sit on a stool so that visitors can see his back, which is completely covered by different colored tattoos. There's a large Virgin Mary in the middle. There's a skull on top of that. Wim, maybe you could explain why you chose these symbols, what they represent for you.
No, it's like an atlas of what tattoo represents. I mean, they're the favorites of the tattoo world. There's the praying virgin, there's the skull, roses. We have bats, we have birds, and then two Chinese children riding koi carps, yeah.
It's incredibly colorful. But it must have been extremely painful to do. I mean, how does it feel, Tim, to be a living canvas?
It's a very exciting new feeling. I've always been looking to see how extreme I could go in certain areas. And as soon as I was told about this concept by one of my favorite artists, if not the favorite artist, Wim Delvoye, I knew that I'm getting myself into something that I can't predict how it's going to go, and I was very excited to become part of this.
But, I mean, what makes Tim's back art? Surely it's just another tattoo?
It's art because it got sold. It's art because it's in the art context. There's things happening to Tim that makes him more and more art. When Tim would die, he will be an art piece.
Now, you say it got sold. It was sold for about $215,000 to a collector, but he can only get his artwork after you die. That's correct, isn't it? He can only remove it from your back. Do you not feel that's slightly macabre?
I don't think so, and I'm asked many times, how do I feel about that? I won't be here anymore. It doesn't matter. And since we're living in the world where so many people are looking for their famous 15 minutes of fame, I have a certain permanence going on that other people at the moment don't have. And that really is, if the project finishes the way it should and the skin will be removed and properly framed, that I will exist forever. At least a part of me will. And I find that concept more exciting than morbid.
That's Tim Steiner and artist Wim Delvoye talking to NPR's Louisa Lim in Shanghai. And you can see photos of Tim's back and of the tattooed pigs at npr.org.